multimedia, multi-genre artist, a local elder in our community, and someone with a lot of perspective, I think, on the interplay between creativity, identity, memory, tradition, community, and future making. Is that fair to say? So the title of Renee's presentation is The Gift of the Red-Tailed Hawk Flute, and please join me in welcoming Renee.
Originally, my name used to be Meshaki Gisik before the white man came. And they cut my name in half, Meshaki. And I'm a member of the Mizai clan, the Mizai Lin clan. The Lin is a teaching clan. So I was born with a job description, whether I liked it or not. Eventually, I become a teacher. I'm very, very blessed to have been born at a time when my grandmother lived on her homelands called Taiwashin, northwestern Ontario. You know where Thunder Bay is? Just northeast of Thunder Bay. She brought me up in the culture, you know. She homeschooled me, and at the same time, she would bring me to Long Lac Indian Day School. There, I learned my ABCs. Learned about Catholicism. And the curious thing about it, so I only have half an hour, so I'm going to cut everything out, like my name. Usually it takes me 2 hours to really get going. Anyway, okay. This instrument is called bibigwan. But I must tell you first that I'm a survivor of Indian residential school where they beat the shit out of me for practicing my language, my arts and culture. And I was taught there. I was abused there, sexually abused and everything else. That went on. Everything to kill the Indian and the child in me. But they didn't. They almost did. So I graduated with a lot of rage. I found a lot of, I could say, some kind of healing in alcoholism. I ended up homeless in Toronto, 6 years of my worst addiction. Lived under the Bathurst Street Bridge because I was told that my arts and culture was inferior. I was an inferior human being. But that was only 24 years ago. Went to a rehab. I've been sober ever since. But what do you do with this sobriety that I found? You know? What's going to sustain sobriety? What's going to keep Renee sober? There's the answer. I got married here in Guelph. I was just looking out my bay window. Oh, I'm married. Whoa. What are you going to do? There was a fog out there, out the window. And the fog divided in the middle and you kind of. And all of a sudden, I saw a bird flew out of the fog, and it flew right across and into the fog again, disappeared. And for the longest time, I didn't understand what that meant. What is this vision? Vision, what is it? You know, didn't make any sense to me. Then there was this, in Fergus, there was this heritage, Aboriginal Heritage Festival. Heritage. I better go check it out. Brought three of my little, I write and illustrate my own books. So I brought those three and I self-publish. Nobody thinks like me. Anyway, we had our booth and I ran across this Jim who visited this guy that was, there was this flute. On his table, he had a beautiful display case. And I walked in, oh, how much is it? And I picked it up, you know. You think, damn it? He said, nope. I got Visa. Nope. He wanted cash. No, I didn't have any cash. So I went back to my table, I sat down, started signing my books, and pretty soon, come on, I need to sell one more book. And the last guy said, okay, ready? Grabbed my cash, ran across the street. Give this guy's check and I was like, as I walked back, I turned around and said, by the way, what is this? What is this fruit called? And he said, that's the red-tailed hawk. See? That's the red-tailed hawk. And, this vision came back to me. That was that bird that flew out of the fog. That was this flute. Mm-hmm. Now I understood. In the meantime, I didn't know how to play this thing. But it felt good. I can feel it. I was happy. Did my little happy dance. And it was the Jesuits that came to, we call them the Black Robes, that came to my village and told my people, don't ever play this instrument again. They were probably destroyed, like everything else, because when I was in my own village in Longmac and Maryland and Pipewashing, nobody, we had never had, used to have powwows. There were no powwows, no drums, no regalias, no jingle dresses, nothing. There was nobody playing the flute either. My grandma, my grandfather didn't play it. My brothers didn't. My uncles didn't. My father didn't. No one played. And for the longest time, you know, things died. So was my heart in the residential school, the whole thing. Trying to. And then this happens. I got this flute. And sobriety. I got sobriety. I got the flute. Then I went to walk here. There's this on the North Highway 6. There's a Jesuit center, mm-hmm. seminary used to be. I went for a walk down there. My hobby was, I started putting my hands in these. Whoa. I gotta find something. That's how it's played. Hey! Then I start to hear crickets. Then I start to hear birds. They flutter around on their wings right above me, and they're all hanging on these lines, and they're all up there. So I started jamming with the birds and the insects around me, and the wind blowing around, and they have kept the music. They have kept the songs for me. And all of a sudden I felt surrounded by my ancestors. The original the pig whaling in New York. That's what they were called, the flute players. And I felt they were around me amongst the clouds and the winds and the birds, and they kept the songs. They were teaching me the music. And one time I was in Sulicout. I was playing by the riverbank, you know. Yourself. Everywhere I take this flute, there's got to be a bird. That's where I get my songs. And this guy, that Philip says he get the Mother Earth keeps the songs, and that's where I'm getting all my music from. The Earth, Mother Earth, and all the creatures. Even a little cricket. Only Buddy Holly is not there. He's a big dark. Why did the Beatles name themselves Beatles? Where did they get their music? The Beatles. Things to me, I can see it. I can hear it. And this bird, red-tailed hawk, has been flying me all over. It flew me to Barcelona. See, I'm working on my healing. 1492, Spain. Christopher Columbus sailed to America. He was lost looking for Indians. He didn't see the flute players, did he? Anyways, yeah, Columbus sailed and I flew. Get that? After many, many years, I went to Spain to tell the people there, I forgive you. Mm. And it was a moving moment for me to discover there are other people there, like Barcelona, that area. They're colonized too. They have flags on their buildings. That wasn't Spanish flags. They have a star and four stripes, yellow, red, you know. They were going to have their referendum to separate from Spain, but I was talking to these people. And I discovered a lot of things there. They had these, I don't know, they had these camps. Very, very, very old camps where they put prisoners in, you know, concentration camps. They put people there. The ground was so red, I started taking pictures of it. I can feel my own rest there. I thought I was back in the rest. So this is where all this idea of reservations come from, you know? Reserves. And to feel the spirits over there very, very heavy, really burdened. It was hard, but I forgave the people. And I told the whole people that were in the presentation, I forgive them. And you know what? They presented me with their own flag. There's a story behind this flag, this Catalonia flag. And it was this general that he was shot, and as he was lying on the ground, they told him to give us a sign. So he drew on the sign, his bloody hands marked, that became the flag. And I felt so honored to bring that home. Now my son has it, and he's going to college. And so that's that story of forgiveness. It's hard for me to forgive. Working on healing. It has a layers and layers and layers and layers. You know, you peel one skin off, and there's another hurt. You peel this one off, there's another hurt. You peel another, there's another hurt. And eventually, hopefully that I will be complete. But for now, the flute. Bipiguan. Bipiguan. Say Bipiguan. He's saying the flute tradition. The Bipiguan. Like I speak Ojibwe. Nitamishnava. See, that's Ojibwe. And this is Bipigwe. It's another language. When you Bipigwe, Bipigwe. In Barcelona. And if I went to Siberia, talk to the Russians up there. And I went to Mongolia. They would understand. Even babies understand this. They brought in, on one of my performances, they brought in a little baby. And as soon as I started playing, grandmother taught me a lot about our culture. Anishinaabe culture is full of improvising. It's a lifestyle. It's a culture. I'm going to tell you a little story here. One time my brother and I went hunting duck season. And we were about 40 kilometers away, and it was getting dark. And the motor kicks out. Uh-oh, we're in trouble, man. Everyone. Because we're stuck in this little creek, it has all kinds, it meanders. If it gets dark, we're in trouble. We didn't have any flashlight. What he did was, I'm having some of this problem. He got it, the duck, pulled out the gut, tied it on his the gas tank, and the intakes in the motor, started up. We got home. That is improvising. Improvising can save your butt. Oh, yeah. And my spoken word also, I use this a lot. And I use it too in ceremonial, too. When they ask me to say opening prayers or honoring the dead. And this is another one. It's the same in the key of G. Resource in much too deep to keep the reservation. Dangerous, uneasy, Anishinaabe, the drunken Indian begets a sober human being and a healer of the nation. We gather to light our sweet grass fires of transformation if Anishinaabe Egoktachki, you come over here. Together, we'll see the last glint on the rustic rails. Life is simply simple on the Ojibwe side of the tracks. We're still here. Leave it. Should I shut off with this one? I started remembering my uncles again, Uncle Peter and Billy. They're getting the fluxing their muscles and getting ready to go. The canoe races. Oh yeah, they're all waiting on the beach, the big beachhead, and everybody else just getting ready. I was too young and I just watched. And down they went. Boy, these guys. Way together, oh way together, oh way together, oh way. That word means to race by canoe. I'm racing. Gueje. Gueje is this. Gueje. You're testing your canoe. This is, pretend this is a paddle. Gueje. Test. Trial. Keta. You know, you try to beat the other guys and you group it. Gueje. Keta. All right. Way together, oh way together, oh way together, oh way together, oh way. Then yeah, repeat that all the way because you're in the rhythm. So there's a lot of rhythm in our families too, or the races. And these are the water, the beachhead. And I try to split the water in half, and there's the water, so you're just swirling around, you know, just the canoe. There's the canoe. This is the story in Chiltec. And what they did out there, this is the original. They want me to digitize all these, and I sent it to them so they can have it big. So if you go see that show, these are enlarged, digital. I love, my work has become very digital right now. Using photography, Photoshop, you know. Facebook is where I post most of my work. It's my gallery. And I'm trying to encourage my cousins up north to stay in school. They don't come down here. It's a tough job. They're dropping out like crazy up there. I'd like to see that. And there's hardly... I like to bring this to them. I'm going there this fall. Just to introduce the flute to them. To the guys, really. They're the ones that need a lot of instruction. If I can only have one or two start playing the flute, it might change the rest. Like it has maintained my sobriety. It's a powerful medicine. And I play it to the thunders when they roll into Guelph. They're loud. And it's raining everywhere. And... thunders quiet down. And they start making noise way down. Not in well. Does that tell the story of me?
Oh yeah.
And I'm really encouraged by all the invitation I have here. This is the very first time I was considering. When will I get to play the Go Jazz Festival? And that's the nearest performance I can give. Most of my performances are in Toronto, all over, except here. This is my very first time. Thanks for bringing me here.
Sing of good things, not bad.
sing of happy, not sad. Sing a song, make it simple to last your whole life long. Don't worry that it's not good enough for anyone else to hear. Just sing a song.
Is taken from the lyrics of Sing, a song that I think many of us might be familiar with, particularly the rendition that the Carpenters, Karen and Richard, did. So I'd like to start my presentation by bringing us all back in time to when that song was first released. I'm in public school, and I love to sing. I'm finally old enough to join the choir for the annual school musical, and every day you can find me practicing the songs to Oklahoma, endlessly. You could ask my mother. In the final week of rehearsals, the choir gathers daily, and not even spelling is as much fun for me as this. On one of these mornings, our music teacher determines that one of us is horribly out of tune. So as we sing for her, she paces up and down the auditorium floor in front of us, listening intently for the offending voice. Now, I am filled with pity for that kid. Singing means so much to me. Mrs. Wagner stops right in front of me. "It's you," she says. "You have to be a square dancer." It's a turning point for me. In that moment, I learn that my voice isn't worthy, that only worthy voices can sing. So now we're going to fast forward in time, several decades. But the most important thing you need to know about the intervening years is that during them, I might often mouth the words to songs, but I rarely ever sing. When I do sing, it's for audiences composed entirely of canine companions. So, we're in July 2014. I'm in St. John's, Newfoundland, at the Summer Institute for Critical Studies in Improvisation. It's an intensive graduate-level course about improvisation and, in this incarnation of the Institute, practice-based research. I'm here to kickstart my fieldwork from my master's thesis in anthropology. The thesis is a study of what it feels like, sensorially, physically, and emotionally, to play and listen to improvised music. Unlike most of my classmates at the Institute, I don't consider myself to be a musician or, even more generally, a performer at all. I'm really at the Institute in a scholarly capacity to learn to listen to improvised music and possibly to connect to potential research participants. All the same, I participate in the practical workshops that we have every afternoon, and I join in the evening improvisational jams. I'm trying to have fun with it, but I'm mostly constantly aware of this hot, prickly sensation that crawls across my skin, which I have since come to call anticipatory embarrassment. One afternoon, we have a session, a workshop, that's conducted by improviser, educator, and postdoctoral fellow Chris Tinelli. Chris is also, as I've mentioned, an improviser. He does what's called sound singing, where conventional singing often emphasizes sort of uniformity in pitch and dynamics. Sound singing really focuses on the timbral space, so those qualities of color and texture and grain that make our voices all distinct from one another. A sound singing concert then might include coughing, barking, laughing, panting, squawking, and wailing, along with a panoply of other human, non-human, and inhuman vocalizations. So to demonstrate for us, Chris gibbers, growls, and sputters at us. His voice rises high into the air with this mosquito-like whine, and then it sinks low into that area of the voice that we call vocal fry, where it creaks and it scrapes, kind of like a trap door opening into a basement crawl space. As he sings, he sometimes pulls and slaps at his cheek and his neck in order to get new sounds coming out. He's looking everywhere for these pockets of sound. So after that experience, in which I felt much embarrassment for him because he was using his voice, period, let alone using it in really extended and experimental ways. Afterwards, Chris gets all of us in the class up onto our feet to stand like a choir in front of him, and I start feeling that hot, prickly sensation. He teaches us a handful of gestures. So among them, there might be one that is about controlling volume that would go like this. And there's another that would be about sustaining a tone. So this would be a mid-tone. This would be a higher tone. And another one, for example, would be this kind of thing that makes us burble and pop when he does it. And so with that, he begins to conduct us. Now, I have strategically buried myself in the back of the pack in order to be unseen and unheard, but then something happens. In my memory, it's as though there was this rip that happened in the time-space continuum. I have no idea how many minutes passed while we were vocalizing, but I know that throughout the whole thing, I have been singing, all of me, like I'm 10 years old again. So when we sit down in our seats, everyone around me seems to be talking about this experience in academic terms, and I can't even sit still. I'm just thrumming with this impossible-to-conceal joy at having been singing again. So this was another turning point for me. For my field work, certainly, my emphasis turned from what would have been a more detached study of musicians through observation and interview to what anthropologist Sarah Pink calls a sensory apprenticeship. That is to say, from the Summer Institute on, I played music, sang, and danced with all of my project participants, mostly in casual improvisational groups that had no set audience in the way that, I'm presenting. You're in the audience now. My goal was to experience what improvised music making feels like from the inside, so not something that's discussed, but something that's felt, to access that tacit knowledge. I'd wanted my research to explore how improvised music making made a difference in the lives of all the colleagues that I was working with, but I think I found that difference most dramatically in my own, and especially through singing. So in the time that remains, I want to share with you three lines of thought I have been pursuing with regard to this highly charged experience, re-experience, I should say, of singing. I use different registers of the meaning of word voice as kind of an organizational motif here and in my thesis. So first, I want to talk a little bit about the idea of the voice as an utterance that's produced with the larynx, particularly how it feels in the muscles and in the flesh to sing. So I'd like first that we consider the voice as the only instrument that is actually part of the organism that plays it. So you can't play your voice without feeling it. So if you could just entertain me right now and just draw in a deep breath and pay attention to the muscles that you feel, not just in your core, but also how does the rest of your body change? So when we add sound to that as well, other muscles come into play. Other parts of our bodies can be felt. So singing, while it might be something that we listen to, when we actually do it, is something that we feel very deeply and very literally. Now, in his 2001 monograph, Sonic Bodies, Julian Enriquez uses the term sonic dominance to describe the immediate and immersive visceral pleasures that a Jamaican dance hall sound system produces, not just for themselves, but of course for all the attendees at a given concert. From the physical vibrations produced by the equipment to the rhythmic movement of close-pressed bodies to the charge of affect that ripples through the crowd, the experience is sensuous and intimate. I've been entertaining the idea that choral singing, especially improvised sound singing, because of the really extended range of sounds that are produced, kind of functions like an acoustic version of dance hall. And I think that this is especially so for singers. So if we consider that the body is a resonating chamber, it contains several resonating chambers in the head, the nasal cavities, the mouth, and the chest. When we sing, each of those chambers in its own way enhances and shapes the sounds that are produced by our vocal cords. We resonate, we vibrate. And when we sing in a group, we're vibrating together. I had the opportunity to interview vocalist, educator, and activist Christine Duncan. And Christine was talking about vibration as being central to human experience. She says, "Your whole body vibrates when you sing. That's why people chant. That's why people tone. That's why healing circles do that. That's why people scream their heads off and cheer and do the kinds of stuff they do at sports games. That's why choirs and all those kinds of things are important." And from my experience, I'd have to agree. Now, the word voice is also used as a metaphor to express our individuality, our difference. So we'll say things like, "Well, feel free to voice your opinion at the end of this presentation," or "Make sure to make your voice count this coming election." Anthropologist Stephen Feld talks about the voice as a social practice that is everywhere locally understood as an implicit index of authority, evidence, and experiential truth. Now, this is the point where I start improvising because the last page of my piece didn't print out. Historian and musicologist Anna Maria Ochoa Gautier, in her book Orality, takes a look through past written records in Colombia through the 18th and 19th centuries, I believe, to see how writing about the speaking voices of people changed. And in it, she was able to track a kind of modernist divide between how the colonizers spoke in human voices, whereas the indigenous people were constantly referenced in animalistic terms. So that this idea of a authoritative voice comes along with the ability to express yourself in very certain and prescribed ways. And I think that sort of thing can apply to how we sing these days. Certainly there's been research about what male voices should be like and how the crooners of the 20s is not a music style that we're happy to listen to now, generally speaking. So as part of my thesis research, when I got back to Guelph from the symposium, I contacted my daughter's singing instructor and asked her if she would be interested in doing some sound singing exploration with my daughter and I. And so for the past year, we've met pretty much once a week to make all kinds of wonderful noise together. And Shannon, who has a beautiful voice, likes to make beautiful sounds. I found that it was really so much fun for me to make those, you know, less than beautiful sounds. So where when we were doing toning around long vowels, Shannon would go for the oohs or the ahs. I really like the ugh. We also did a lot of vocal play using animal sounds and then allowing those sounds to morph into whatever they did from there. And for me, it was a phenomenal experience. And while my metaphorical voice may include being a mother and a partner and a scholar and a designer and an activist, they all speak in the voice that you're listening to now. It gave me a chance to sort of access other voices and the emotions and the feelings that go with them, which sometimes would better express how I might be feeling in a given moment, even though I might express it in this voice. So that for me was a wonderful exploration. The final type of voice that I would like to speak about is how voice can grammatically assert a particular relationship between the subject of a verb and the action with that which that verb expresses. So we have an active voice, I sang to my daughter, and we have a passive voice. So in that example, I am singing, so I'm active. In the passive voice, the lullaby was sung. The lullaby in this instance is passive because someone has done an action to it. In ancient Greece, there was another verb tense that is called the middle voice. And in the middle voice, the doer is also the one to which something is done. The closest example of this that I could come up with would be the idea of self-reflexive verbs in French. So where a translation might be, I wash myself, so that in the process of washing, I am changed. This idea of the middle voice has become really compelling to me, given all of the changes I've felt in myself through the course of my research. And so it seems to me that for us to have opportunities to be moved, to be changed by the things that we participate in, we need spaces in order to do so. For me, finding sound singing, finding an instructor who was game to play along with me with that, circles like the improvisation circle that happens here at Silence every Monday morning, spots where there's not an audience, where there's not a performance agenda per se, but an opportunity to explore and create together, are absolutely crucial. And I wish that we had more of them. I'm going to close to tell you a little story about why this is so crucial. We had a morning back in April trying to get my daughter off to school. I had someplace to go. I had a bus to catch. My partner had a work meeting to get to. And we had one of those mornings where nobody was working as part of a team. So by the time we got in the car, we were all, I think the technical term is, pissy with one another, and tensions were high. As we were making the 5-minute drive to my daughter's school, she started making these noises in the back seat, these kind of smacking noises. And I was thinking, oh, what is she eating? She knows those noises drive me crazy. But I took a moment and realized that there was a pattern to the smacking. And I thought, oh, maybe that's an invitation. So I started making little chirping noises in the front seat. And then our noises changed a little bit. And my partner, who was driving, kind of looked at us, realized what was happening. And he added his own little sounds in. By the time we dropped my daughter off at school, we were all happy. And it set a beautiful tone for the day. So having space to explore and play gives us tools that we can take into other walks of our lives as well. Thanks.
Sound It Out is produced in conjunction with the International Institute for Critical Studies and Improvisation. You should go to improvcommunity.ca to find out more. Sound It Out is also a podcast. Go to iTunes to find it. I'm Rachel Elliott. Bye.
Hi, my name is Kevin, and back in the 80s I used to hang around CFRU all the time. Anyone can volunteer here. Just email volunteer@cfru.ca or visit cfru.ca for more information. Thank you.
Thank you.